So I thought I had three surprising predictions, and I actually had three bits of preamble, one of which was, of course, thank you for the kind invitation, and I'm thrilled to be here, I really am, and the group of people that have been put together I think is so exciting, so I hope to get a chance to chat with a lot of you while I'm here, but I'm only here for 2 days. So hopefully we can work that in. I also wanted to say that this talk is a bit of an overview, so I've been modeling experimental evolution for about 10 years, I think, actually, in parallel with other research efforts in my group. And so this is an overview of three of the kind of most interesting, what I think are the most interesting counterintuitive predictions that we've made. So some of this will be repeat, some of it's quite old actually, and will be repeat material for some of you, so I apologize for that. And the other thing was that I took the guidance for speakers seriously and prepared only 30 slides, so you can watch them go by and know when the end is approaching, and there should be lots of time for questions and discussion. And if not, of course, I have another 30 slides. I actually do have another 30 slides in my Bible about some more recent stuff that I'm doing on fungus. So if you want to hear about fungus, then we have to get through this. Okay, so this is Phil's figure, which he made 10 years ago for our joint paper, and I've been using ever since. Microbes, as you all know, have the ability to grow in population size very rapidly, and to counterbalance that, we need to typically grow them in a chemostat where we're always sloughing off, draining some microbes out, or else very commonly we have this kind of serial transfer regime. So I guess everyone's familiar with this. You start with N0 individuals at the beginning of day one, and the population size grows to N final. And a real physical pointer, I love that. Good. And then N0, you probably can't see that very well, are transferred to a fresh medium at the beginning of day two, for example. And so the population grows exponentially and then is sampled, and this is called a population bottleneck. So population bottlenecks, I found kind of fascinating when I started working on this. I wanted to know the effect of the population bottlenecks on the underlying population genetics in these populations, which brought us to surprise number one. And this was a really old result, like 2002, I think. But I haven't really talked about it as much as maybe I should have. So I think bottlenecks can increase rates of adaptation, which I think is counterintuitive to most people. They do reduce the fixation probability for a given beneficial mutation that occurs at a certain time. When it has to face this population bottleneck, it's likely to get eliminated. So each mutation might have a reduced fixation probability, but if you think about it, suppose, and this first surprise, I'm thinking of E. coli or bacterial populations, sort of the model in my head, and we could talk about how much this would apply to other experimental preps. But if you think about a bacterial population, how are we going to maintain it at a constant size? You have two offspring per individual, and there's only one on average that survives, right? Be that through, well, let's just say we're maintaining it at a constant size, so let's say it's in a chemostat. So this is like a bottleneck where only 0.5 of everybody survives, right? Every generation. So in a sense, you have to, even at a constant size, you have to always be culling, right?
So this is like Fisher.
Yeah, if you're thinking of fission, right? And because bacteria don't have a Poisson distribution of offspring, right? They have two. So here was our surprising result. This is the expected number of successful mutations. So these are mutations that occur and survive extinction when rare. And this is just different values of the selective advantage. I've assumed here, and this is a whole other kettle of fish, that the available mutations, the beneficial available mutations, are exponentially distributed, but we could change that. If we hold the population constant at the initial size, overall this dotted line is how many occur and survive at each value of S. And if we bottleneck it really extremely, like 1 in 1,000 survive at the bottleneck, then only this many survive. And that probably jives with your intuitions. Or if you bottleneck where 90% of them survive, you actually get even fewer mutations occurring and surviving, because far fewer are occurring here. You don't have a lot of growth going on here. And if you let the population double every generation and then bottleneck it back down so that you're keeping the population size constant, if you keep it constant at the initial side or constant at the final size, in either case, you get less, you have fewer successful mutations predicted than if, for example, you bottlenecked at 0.1, so 10%. You let them grow, you do like three doublings, three population doublings, and then let 10% through. Then this was really a surprise to me. You have more successful mutations in that case. And let me show you another figure. This was work with Phil.
This is the contrast between the chemostat and batch transfer. The flasks you showed.
I think so. Here is, let's look at the dilution ratio. So this is, or I would call it now the bottleneck ratio. We called it the dilution ratio then, way back when. So this is the fraction of the organisms that survive the bottleneck. And there's this peak, and this is, well, fraction, basically relative fixation probability. There's this peak. This is for a very simplified model, exponential growth between bottlenecks, and then a perfect binomial bottleneck. You sample them all with exactly the same probability. But this peak of fixation probability occurs then under many assumptions at e to the minus 2 or 0.135. So for bottlenecks at that rate.
So what's the difference now between the dashed and the solid line?
That's a good question, Klaus. How do I go back? Page up. Yeah, the dash, I think those are two different values of S that I just used to demonstrate, and you could fill it all in.
And you space your bottlenecks such that the overall size of the population is always the same.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so you let them grow longer or shorter and then bottle them back down to the same. And actually, no, you know what I did? That's the first way you think of doing it, but here I thought what's really constraining us is an N final, probably by your vessel size or maybe by the sugar concentration or who knows. So we grow up to the same N final and bottleneck down to a different N zero and stretch the time to get the different dilution ratios.
Right? So then it's not really right Fisher, you have overlapping generations, right? You have a continuous time model.
Mm-hmm. You have a continuous time. In fact, in this model, this really simplified model where we can get this nice result, you just have exponential growth so that nobody dies. This is really important, actually, to this model. None of the mutants die except in the bottleneck. There's only death in the bottleneck. But from what I hear from experimentalists in sufficiently rich sugar broth, you kind of expect that these populations just grow exponentially, and it's very rare that you lose a bacterium. But that's a really, if you do, that's a really important thing to add to the model.
So this is really, is this all being driven by adjusting the variance in reproductive, in the number of offspring among individuals?
Well, you're adjusting the variance in, yes, but that all comes by coming through the bottleneck.
I understand.
Yeah.
But that's really where it enters. I mean, last week, someone in this room gave a talk, and I'm sorry, in which they said the probability fixation is 2s divided by it was.
Yeah, variance squared.
Was it Nick or was it you? It was you.
Both of us.
Yeah, it was you. Divided by the variance.
Yeah.
So if it's plus 1, that's 1. And so is that, can we think of this as that?
I have. Yeah. Although there are counterexamples. So this is absolutely true. When S is close enough to 1,
right.
Or S is close enough to 0, rather, right? When fitness is close enough to 1. But if in these, like, especially in the viruses, right, when you get these fitnesses, S is 13, that doesn't hold anymore.
But then you could presumably stick in some diffusion expression for probability fixation unit and still divide by the variance?
You can even use the branching process approximation still, and then it's like 1 minus e to the negative S or something like that.
Yeah.
But then this effect is all being driven in the denominator of that?
Yeah. I think so. I think that's true.
Well, this is for S, which is determining reproductive success based on making progeny, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you could break that down into different fitness components.
What a great question. But yeah, that's the next bit. Yeah, that's the next bit. And I think when you can break it down and you can independently adjust your probability of having zero offspring from the rest of the distribution, mm-hmm. it's still going to come down to the variance mm-hmm. when S is close to zero. But it's your intuitions kind of fall apart a little bit because that probability of having zero offspring has a huge effect. And the rest of the distribution we don't really care about. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the real surprise, well, it's 1B, is that if you're in this regime where bottlenecks are increasing fixation, then they also will reduce stochasticity in the evolutionary trajectory. And one thing to wrap your head around this, I think the way to think about it is that it's really the periods of growth that distinguish these growth bottleneck protocols, not the bottlenecks. Because to keep the population size constant, you've got to be culling all the time. But if you have these periods of sustained growth where you don't cull, and little mutants can build new little families of mutations around themselves for a while before they face that first bottleneck, that's really what's distinguishing about this serial transfer. And so you can get higher adaptation rates with serial transfer because of that, as long as your bottleneck is neither too severe nor too frequent, right, if you're in this happy middle zone.
This is like that paper that Sally wrote about probably fixation of growing or shrinking populations.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because you have the growing population for a while. Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I think you read a lot about bottlenecks increasing stochasticity. And that is true if you're bottlenecking down to one individual, obviously, right? But these serial transfer where you're bottlenecking at 10%, that's not true. You're actually increasing the reproducibility of the experiment, I guess. Okay, so to Paul's question, to get to surprise number two, I'm going to move away from my mental model of bacteria and think about lytic viruses.
Actually, can I just ask one more question?
Yeah.
This is now a new topic, right?
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, there have been quite a few studies on parallel evolution. I wonder, will you get more parallel evolution at a particular bottleneck
yeah,
size?
I think you will.
That might be a simple thing.
Yeah.
Study,
yeah, I think there's a concrete testable prediction there. Yeah, absolutely.
So you mean parallel in terms of fitness, or do you mean parallel in Alan Orr's sense?
Parallel in the sense that you see the same mutations.
Yeah, so the way Alan.
You reduce the stochasticity, so you get the same outcome.
Yeah, I'd predict that at one end or the other end of the spectrum of your bottleneck ratio, it would be more stochastic, and somewhere there's a sweet spot where you get more parallel evolution. I wouldn't bet too much money on that sweet spot because there's so many assumptions.
You mean
assumptions.
Where exactly?
Yeah, is it 0.135? Yeah.
But I just think it might be an important result, right? Because these papers, they say, oh, there's so much parallel evolution, and then other papers sometimes say, oh, it's not. But nobody really knows why, and maybe to some extent it's just the specific experimental setting that they chose. So that might be an interesting result.
I also think that work for me to do is do the right effective population size, the adaptation effective population size for this. And then we could have, you know, we'd like to all just have a number that applies to your population. Because I don't think the effective population size that's used, that actually Phil and my paper gets quoted for a lot, I'm not sure that's the right one to capture this effect. We could talk about that. Yeah?
Say something a little more about why the parallelism would be at the level of the genotype and not just at the level of fitness.
The parallelism? So you have all these stochastic mutations that may or may not happen. And if everybody's fixation probability is higher, you're more likely to get the big ones fixing, and yet then you'll see them over and over again if you have multiple lineages running. So that's the parallel evolution.
But I agree, you expect that this brings parallel fitness evolution at some point. No? mean, if you see the same fixation of, or the same mutation fixed, I mean, fitness could be an overall estimate of what's happening at the genetic level. Am I wrong, or?
I'm not understanding,
okay,
sorry.
What I understood from the question was whether you expect to see a parallel evolution of fitness or of mutation, right?
Right, yeah, so yeah, you will see parallel evolution of fitness if you have, Okay, on we go then. So that everybody's up to speed, because not everyone knows and loves lytic viruses to the extent that I now do. This is not to scale, but here are some free phage floating around in the soup, right? In a rich soup of, you know, sugar broth and host cells, and they float around until they randomly bump into the right part of the host cell so they can inject their genetic material and infect this cell. And the time that that takes, there's good experimental evidence that that's roughly exponentially distributed, and it's called the attachment time. Okay, then once they've infected the cell, they take a while to turn the cell into a phage-building factory, and they lytic viruses means they build up a whole bunch of phage inside them, and rather than butting them off one by one, they actually explode the cell, and they all burst out at once. And the time that that takes is called the lysis time. This explosion is lysis. And lysis, that's actually really a fascinating process in and of itself. So the lysis time is actually very tightly regulated. So I guess for physicists, actually, I should have this as a probability distribution, and this should just be a peak at one time, right? And the SD on that is only plus or minus about 5% in experimental systems. So there are people who study, you know, how is it that these phage can regulate the lysis time so beautifully? But they do. So they stay, well, you'll see some data soon, but they might take an hour to attach, and then it might take 50 minutes, and it's really 50 plus or minus 5 minutes to lyse, and then they have a burst of daughter phage. Okay, that's all clear. So in classical population genetics, almost always we think about the wild type having one offspring. For every one offspring that the wild type has, a beneficial mutant has one plus S offspring. And we just, so that's where we start our models. We increase the number of surviving offspring. And as Paul pointed out, in lytic viruses, beneficial mutations could increase the attachment rate, right? Find cells faster, reduce the lysis time, get out faster, put out 120 baby virions instead of 100, or, oh, clearance. I didn't talk about clearance. Did I have that up there? I did, but it's really low. Clearance. So there's some probability that these phage, even if we're doing bottlenecked protocols, these guys could stick to the vessel walls. Or another thing they can do is, there's a lot of dead cells. There may be a lot of dead cells floating around in the soup, and these guys may be attaching to dead cells and therefore having abortive attempts at infection. So maybe they could do that less. Somehow they have a mutation that makes them not attach to dead cells. And obviously, if we have a chemostat model, there may be something they can do to avoid getting sucked out the chemostat. So they could maybe reduce the clearance rate, or in fact, some combination of all four, which brings me to some data. So these are Christina Birch's data. They are mutants, strains, I don't know if strain's the right word, of Phi6, which is a bacteriophage, and here are their attachment rate. For those of you that know, this is the sort of what I would call the overall attachment rate, and with a per capita attachment rate that is usually used in literature is K, and N is the density of host cells. So this is overall per minute, how fast they attach. And I've highlighted the smallest and largest values, so you can see that there's about a five-fold difference among these mutants. So pretty big changes can happen in attachment rate. The lysis time is about an hour. This is about an hour, too, on average. The lysis time is about an hour, and it doesn't change by as much among these mutants. and the burst size is sort of 100, but look at this. And here's, there's an 18 and there's 125. And the lysis time is not so different for these guys. So again, a five-fold difference. So to attack this, I'm actually going to do some math now. There's sort of three cases. One case is that the attachment time is really super short, in fact negligible, and the lysis time is really long, and then population generation times are roughly constant, and then classical population genetics is fine. We've done that case before. That's what's in the literature. Another case is that if we have a really long attachment time compared to a short, and in fact negligibly short lysis time. So I'm going to do that case, and then I'll do the case where neither is negligible. So if we have this long attachment time, then generation times are exponentially distributed. In our heads, what happens is the phage wait to attach, and then as soon as they attach, they burst. Right? And so then we can use a classic birth-death model from stochastic processes, except I call it the burst-death model because instead of, in the birth-death model, there's one offspring, one's an offspring, and here we're going to have about 100. And in fact, I'm going to fix it to be exactly, say, 100. One fixed number. So another way to think about this model is that in classical population genetics, we have a stochastic number of offspring, say a Poisson distribution, and a fixed generation time. Boom, boom, boom. And in this model, instead, I'm going to have a stochastically distributed generation time and then a fixed number of offspring, 100, 100, 100. So here's the math. So this is all probability generating functions, and yeah, I'm not really going to go slow enough that if you haven't seen them before, you'll get it, but if you have seen them before, then I think this should be clear. So we have a dummy variable X, and we have a discrete probability distribution for the number of offspring in a lineage, say. So this is the probability there are zero offspring in the lineage at time t, the probability that there's one offspring in the lineage at time t and two, and you kind of store these in your function as coefficients of the appropriate power of x. That's how a probability generating function works. And it has beautiful properties. So if I have this probability generating function for the number of offspring in a lineage at time t, what would it look like at t plus delta t? It would be what it was, plus or minus some little bits. And you can see that, for example, if I went from 1 to b or b plus 1 individuals in the lineage, I'd have to take a little bit of this probability away, and I'd have to add it over here to the coefficient of x to the b plus 1. So this is all I'm doing. So we'll condition, there might be one offspring in the lineage right now. If so, the probability that there's an attachment, oh, sorry, I should back up. You've probably all read this now. Time interval delta t, probability of attaching is at rate alpha, probability of clearing mu, and as soon as they attach, there's a burst of exactly b offspring. So maybe there's one offspring in the lineage right now. If so, this is the probability of attaching. And if that happens, we have to add this whole bit of probability mass to the coefficient of x to the b, and we have to subtract that same bit of probability mass from x to the 1, because there isn't 1 in the lineage anymore. Right? And likewise, if there were 2, same deal, except now the probability that there's an attachment event is 2 alpha delta t, and we're going to add 2 x to the b plus 1 and subtract from x squared. On we go. And deaths are the same deal. There's a probability that there's a death, and if so, we have to add to the coefficient of x to the 0. Now there's nobody left in the lineage, and subtract that bit of probability mass from x to the 1, etc., etc. So we combine terms, and it looks like this. And then I can also remind you, if you have a g of xt that looks like this, then di g di x is p1, 2p2. You know what's beautiful about this result is that I can use it in my first year calculus as an example and get kids to do this, or at least second. I guess we have to wait till multivariable 3p3. And So this is the sum I pi x to the I minus 1. So for example, there's a term right there. And for the other terms, we just do some factoring, and we get this really nice expression, beautiful PDE for how the probability generating function evolves in time. And then once we have the probability generating function evolving in time, we take it out to time tau, which is the time at which the bottleneck occurs. We compose it with the bottleneck probability generating function. We find a fixed point. We've got the extinction probability. And I can, if anyone wants to see all that machinery, I can tell you about that in gory detail.
I'm just wondering, so you, I understand the first term, and then you say when you have two, you have to add a factor of two.
Mm-hmm.
You're making some sort of approximation there.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So I'm ignoring terms of that would be of order delta t squared, right? Okay. They can't both attach in the same instant. Yeah, that's an excellent question.
That's fine, even if you sum to infinity?
Yep, it's actually going to be fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Trust me.
I guess you get a final result and you can compare it to numerical simulations, right?
Yeah, yeah. We did, in fact, yeah. But I'm pretty confident that it's fine. Yeah. Okay. That's a really good I meant to mention that actually. Okay, so here are some results. Perhaps not surprisingly, if you compare fixation probability, this is fixation probability versus the selection coefficient. Here's a classic model where you have a Poisson distribution of offspring with mean 1 or 1 plus s. If you do this birth-death model instead, fixation probabilities go way, way down. There's a log scale. This is for this example that I've shown you is for mutations that increase the burst size. That's why there's not dots everywhere. There's continuous lines. So if you think about it, you're never allowing anyone to burst and have zero offspring. If they burst, in the extreme case, if they burst, they have 100 offspring. You need to have a lot of death to counteract that, right? Or really severe bottlenecks, either a lot of clearance or a lot of death. And so that really hits fixation probabilities hard because you have a big P0 term there. That's what's going on there. So this is all, oh, sorry, I didn't mention, this is for a population of constant size. Pi is much smaller than classically predicted. Okay, now let's look at the different types of mutation. This was a real eye-opener for me, although
what do you mean by classically predicted?
2S.
Oh, this is a yeah. Classic technique.
Yeah, sorry. It was the Poisson, whoops, I forget backspace. This is Poisson distribution of offspring.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's not 2S when S is up here, but it's the right thing.
Yeah.
Something you said. Yeah, exactly.
Here we do saturate because the burst size is large compared to 1 over s for a lot of those.
Yeah, sorry. So this is fixation probability again versus fitness. So this is basically s on a different scale. And these mutations all have exactly the same fitness, yet their fixation probabilities are really different. So these are the mutations that can escape clearance somehow. Not surprisingly, they do really well. And mutations that attach faster do better, and increasing your burst size from 100 to 120, that really increases your fitness and overall growth rate, long-term growth rate, right? But it doesn't have commensurate effects on your fixation probability. And that, I think I have it on the next slide. Yeah, so this we have a proof for. A summer student, a very gifted summer student in mathematics, actually proved this analytically. So, and this was Christina Birch's quip, actually, not all beneficial mutations are created equal. And it's maybe not surprising, there are many components to fitness, and different components of fitness affect long-term growth rate versus fixation probability. But for me, it was a surprise because I'm so used to doing models where, well, first, I just use 1 plus s for any beneficial mutation. And second, if I need to talk about fixations, I'll just say, well, we don't know exactly what it is, but it's proportional to s, isn't it? And this is not true anymore. So, like I said, clearance always, if you can escape clearance, you always have a higher chance of fixing. Burst size is in the middle. Burst size is down at the bottom, and burst rate is in the middle. And this is the proof that Helen did. This holds for all parameter regimes for the burst death model.
So, sorry, I don't get this. So if you say fitness is divided in different components, how can you then say four mutations with the same fitness? What does that mean?
Like the same, let's call it the same long-term growth rate.
They have different extension.
Yeah, they get that long-term growth rate through a combination of their burst size, their birth rate, and their attachment. Yeah.
Can you test this in any way?
No, I would love to.
I'm trying to understand how, what you're saying is that they're gonna have the same magnitude of S.
Mm-hmm.
But in that previous graph, you would expect a certain phenotypic response.
Well, you'd accept to, if you could find mutations that did this, you'd expect to see them fixing, you'd see them in your experiments more than you see these types of beneficial mutations.
So we took 5-6 and we moved it onto a new post.
Mm-hmm.
And we tested what changed first.
Mm-hmm.
Published it yet. But we saw that what changed first is that they improved attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And then they improved burst size.
Yeah.
And coming like 5 replicate cultures with the same magnitude of phenotypic response was very deterministic, surprisingly. So
yeah, that's interesting.
I assumed it was because the largest benefit mutations were for attachment.
Well, see,
what you're saying is that that's possibly not the case.
Well, I would say that there's a bias in fixation probability towards mutations in this order. But there's also what's available. And just like you said, and what has the biggest benefit
among what's available. So I guess it would be hard for us, unless we did a lot more work to figure out.
Yeah, I think it would be hard. And there's more, actually, that this, you'll see a bit more about this later.
If you took all those strands of Christina's and you didn't show the column for fitness, but she presumably knows them all, and then you had to take competition.
Yeah.
You could take two that have that were in the last column, they have the same value, but they gain it by different values in the intermediates, and you could predict.
Wouldn't that be a great grant proposal? Wouldn't you fund that grant proposal? I personally would have liked to see that grant proposal funded, but yeah, we're still trying to.
Question about the mechanisms of mutations that would improve resisting clearance, presumably.
Yeah.
That's all outside the host, right?
There's the attaching to the dead hosts that are lying around. So it's still outside the host, but it might relate to the host. So if there's dead host cells floating around, some viruses will try to attach them and sort of waste themselves there.
Somehow.
Yeah.
They're not really deciding on anything. What the mechanism could be reversible binding. If they're actually sloppier at binding to stuff, then they could bind to the wrong thing, come off, and then bind to the right thing.
That's going to change the attachment fitness as well.
I feel like it's ironic, but sloppier attachment.
Hmm. Right.
Processes and viruses can provide more long-term success.
I'm still wrapping my head around fitness.
Right.
So your fitness components, when you're saying they're equal fitness, that would be sort of their law of growth rate.
Yeah.
So in fact, if you were to integrate over fitness in their environment, they probably come out right this way or not.
No. I'm not sure. Integrate fit. You can think about invasion fitness versus fitness. It's a little different because we're not talking frequency dependent effects here. It doesn't matter who else is in the soup or who you're competing against, but it's a little bit like that, where your invasion fitness is different from.
So if you went 10 transfers starting with one of the mutants relative to wild type, and it's a clearance mutant versus a burst size mutant, they would have the same number of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once they're established. So that, you know, there's this initial. Oh, sorry guys over there. There's this initial time when the mutant frequency is really low and may go extinct, right? right? And once it gets to a certain level where it's essentially deterministic growth, this is, we can measure the log growth rate out here, and these guys would all be exactly the same. Once they became established, they'd have the same fixation time, they'd have the same growth rate against the wild type, they'd do exactly the same in a competition experiment, you couldn't tell them apart, but getting established is very different.
Is log growth rate integrated across multiple bottlenecks?
Yeah, sure. But after that.
What they just said is right. There might be a little bit missing. So it doesn't matter who they're competing with or anything, and that's right. That this is their fitness, no matter what. But when you say across all parameter ranges, you just mean when the mutations are not actually competing with each other. If you have multiple beneficial mutations in the population at the same time, that where they can be lost after they establish.
Mm-hmm.
Then this picture could change.
It could, but this
pattern where they have exactly the same fitness.
If they have exactly the same fitness, yeah.
But you know, someone with a who has, you know, better fitness because of their large burst size, even if they have a lower fixation probability calculated this way, could actually have a higher fixation probability when the two mutations are actually competing against each other.
I really have to think about that.
Only if the one with the higher burst size actually had a higher fitness than the one with the lower clearance rate, so that it could beat it out.
If it had a higher, yeah.
Common.
Yeah.
Only
if, yeah.
Yeah. So that, getting back to Paul's thing, that could maybe, I don't really know the details, maybe be a way to test some of this. If you really cranked up the population size to huge amounts of mutations had to compete against each other, maybe you would lower some of this bias.
I see. So if we redid our experiment at different population sizes, it might reveal to us whether there is actually different underlying, I don't know, a way we can infer whether there's a different underlying distribution or magnitude.
Yeah, because if you could do it big enough, then your fixation probability effects will be washed out, basically. So then you could see if there were effects at your smaller population size. If, I don't know how big enough would be.
But then you deal with clonal interference, and then also
multiple mutation, even beyond clonal interference. Yeah. That's what he wants.
So things change when you move into a big N U.
Okay. So yeah, I think we've said all this. We did say all this. In fact, we did this slide, right? I think, is this doing anything?
Yeah.
Okay, I should leave it.
Okay. I don't think it's on though.
It's from the web.
It's just recording.
It's always on.
Oh, it's recording. Okay, expect the quality of the talk to go really rapidly downhill. Okay, so the burst death model. This will become more interesting later. This is a slide just to kind of set the stage. So if we make longer and longer times between bottlenecks, notice how we have this beautiful smooth increase in the fixation probability. That's basically all I want to say about this slide. Just keep that in mind, because later things won't be so smooth. So now I wanted to address case two, where the attachment time and the lysis time are both of comparable order, and we can't neglect either of them. So first we tried simulating. These were Christina's mutants that we saw earlier, some subset of them. Here I'm doing longer or shorter time between bottlenecks. And this is the predictions of our simulations, predicted fixation probability. And Christina just asked me to do this quickly so she could find a good time. You know, she wants to know, if I go out longer and longer, presumably I'll see more fixation, but where's a good time? When does things start to settle? And I really spent a long time like trying to debug this simulation, because these results were really strange. And you know, I could tell her things like, well, if you bottleneck at 2 hours, I predict you won't see any of this particular mutant, right? So I wanted to look into that further. So I got another gifted graduate student to do that. So here's the bigger model, very similar. While the virus is free, there's a constant probability of clearance and a constant probability of attachment. Now there's a fixed lysis time, so there's a bit of a delay before the constant burst of size B. And we want the probability generating function for one lineage, beginning with one free virion at time t equals zero. And I'm going to just sample the free virions. So I go out to the bottleneck, and at the bottleneck, I only take free virions that are floating in the soup. I don't take any infected cells, but I'll come back to that for, I guess, surprise number three. So clearance and attachment are competing exponentially distributed processes, let's say at some rate theta. And so the lifetime of the free virion has this probability density. And we should remember for later the probability of clearing before attaching will just be this ratio. Okay, so what do we do with that? I'm going to do things slightly differently, but I'll talk you through it. I think it's pretty, in the end, it's pretty elegant, but we have to get there. So I'm going to condition on when the initial virion either attaches or clears. So we are standing here at time t, and we want to know the probability dense, or, well, let's do the PGF here. And at time zero, there was one free virion. So with the easy case, we want to look at time u, the time at which the virion either attaches or clears. Either way, it's kind of out of the picture. Okay? And so that's going to happen with this probability density function. Now, if it attaches or clears in this window, things are really easy because there's no free virion anymore at time t. If it's cleared, it's gone, and if it attaches, it's still inside the cell, right? Likewise, if it attaches or clears, or if it's going to attach or clear first in this interval, things are also easy. At time t, there's just one free virion. And the tricky part is if it attached or cleared in this window, we'll have to deal with that a bit more carefully. So this is basically just the conditioning, right? Where in these square brackets, I want to put the PGF at time t, given that our single progenitor virion cleared or attached at time u, which was in this interval, or this interval. Yeah? Okay. So, like I said, the easy ones, if nothing's happened yet, then our PGF is x. So this is 1 times x to the 1. With probability 1, there's one free phage. And there's nothing more to be said. If it's cleared or attached within big T time units, remember big T is the lysis time, that's our delay, then the PGF is 1 with probability 1. There's no free phage because it's either cleared or attached. Okay, what if it's in this window? The easy part of this is that with this probability, the virus was cleared, and then your PGF is just 1 again. Nobody's out there. And the harder bit is with the complementary probability, the initial virion attached. And if it attached at time u, then it has to wait until u plus t. And at u plus t, it produces b identical copies of itself. And this is the beautiful part, they each grow their little families according to the exact same probability generating function. And by the wonders of probability generating functions, you can just write that this way. So with this probability, it was cleared. And with this probability, it creates B identical copies of itself. And they have how long to grow? They have the time between U plus T, this is when they come out, and T, where we're standing right now. Yeah? Okay, awesome. So we just kind of put that all in. And then presto changeo, we integrate, we change some variables.
I have a question. You said that x equals 1 if it's attached, so then you're only counting free virions here. But a number of free virions is not a Markov process, right? I mean, am I misinterpreting it?
I'll talk to you later about this question. This is right. This is the right way to do it. Okay. It comes into the G with the delay term, my first impression was exactly the same thing, that we're ignoring those guys, and we're not. Yeah, it's okay, yeah. So presto changeo, and we get this PDE, which is really just an ODE.
Amazing that you can integrate over U, the this expression in G that you don't have G yet and you have a delay and everything.
Yeah.
Pretty nasty.
Yeah, yeah. It's in like the appendix to some genetics paper if you want to actually see it. Yeah, I can give it to you. And I can't really take credit. This is Sahir, a very good PhD student.
Do you remember like any, what is the key trick? Change of variable?
There is a change of variables I've got there, but I couldn't tell you what it was. Yeah, sorry, Klaus.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, it becomes this beautiful expression. And in fact, this expression is so beautiful that I think probably there's a nicer way to get it. You can kind of see that you have this loss at rate alpha plus mu, and you have this loss forever at rate mu, and you have the B identical copies of itself with the delay after you've attached. Like, it's all kind of in there. But could you start with a blank piece of paper and write this? I couldn't, but I think that there should be an argument that could get you straight there, right? Because it's so elegant. So here are the real phage mutants, just to remind you. And these guys, remember, they had about, their generation time is about 2 hours. It took them about an hour to attach and an hour of lysis time. And here are, yeah, isn't that nice? These are analytical results. And for these guys, we have, I think, time length one for attachment and one for lysis time. And these are pure mutants. None of Christina's were really pure in the sense that only one of those three attributes or four attributes changed. But these are, they're the solid line. We increase the attachment rate. For B, we increase the burst size, reduce the lysis time, all by the same amount such that their long-term growth rate would be identical. And you can see how incredibly sensitive the fixation probability is to the length of the time interval between bottlenecks. And it's even worse if we allow that there might be mutations that can escape that clearance. Then they have these huge oscillations. So if you bottlenecked at a generation time, you'd predict a 0.55 fixation probability versus it goes down to 0.05 or something if you just, your bottlenecks a little bit later. These are sharper than they would be, I think, in real experimental systems, because these guys all have exactly, the lysis time is fixed to exact. There's no variance. The variance is small, but it would start washing out faster then.
And no variance in burst size either.
Yeah. That effect, though, is not such a big, doesn't make a big difference. Once you're at burst size 100, if you have 90, that we looked at, and it's really insensitive.
Is the bottleneck done by taking the supernatant and throwing out all the cells?
You guys are, that's the next part of the talk. So in this one, the bottleneck is done by just throwing out all the cells.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just taking free virions. Yeah.
That's why the black line hits zero right before it's hit.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so huge effects on fixation. Again, and then also the other thing is, like, look at this. These guys have the same long-term growth rate, the same S value, and their fixation probabilities are orders of magnitude different. So maybe not surprisingly, the most fit mutations are not the most likely to fix. The length of the time between bottlenecks has a really strong effect. It's basically, it imposes huge selection pressures on which mutations you're going to see. Fixation isn't proportional to S by any means. And again, mutations which can reduce clearance, if you can avoid sticking to the vessel walls somehow or infecting dead cells, or maybe do messy binding, all suggested, those will be strongly selected for in fixation as compared to their effects on long-term growth. And my intuition is that these qualitative conclusions probably would hold for other experimental systems that have this, if they have a kind of delay. So I guess what I'm saying here is that I don't think it's too model dependent, these overall conclusions. Okay, so more about, I'm going to move on. Okay. So more about the bottlenecks. As I said, these results were all for transfer of free virions only at the bottleneck. But then when we started to realize how sensitive fixation probability, I guess, is to all these details, we thought, what about this detail of how we're doing the bottleneck? We better look at that. So one point is that free virions being transferred is like viruses being transferred to a new host. You cough kind of semi-free virions. I guess you don't cough infected cells, apparently, onto new people. But what about in experiments we do direct transfer or lytic transfer? So direct transfer means you just sample whatever's there, including infected cells, put them all into the new environment. Or you can artificially lyse the cells, and then if there are any mature virions sitting around in an infected cell that was just about to burst, you sample those too. And we wanted to know how that changes things. And at one point, direct transfer, you could think about the environment. Seasonality might be a sort of natural analog for direct transfer. So the whole environment shrinks and then grows again and shrinks at some periodic basis. I don't know if there's, you know, outside of the world of experiments in the lab, is there a kind of lytic transfer that happens? You guys can help me. So, oh, this is the like worst figure in the universe award. I'm sorry about this figure, but this is, again, like we've been looking at, fixation probability, well, substitution rate in this case, versus time between bottlenecks. And we have the three mutant types, attachment, burst size, lysis time. And we see kind of the same sort of mess. But the interesting thing here is that these top two lines in all the figures are two different cases, basically two different parameter sets where we artificially lyse the cells before we transfer. This is sampling free virus only, and direct transfer is way down here. Two different parameter sets for direct transfer. And
what is lytic transfer?
An artificial lysis of infected cells, and then transfer the free virions plus whatever mature virions were in the cells.
That makes a difference. Why?
That's a really good question. Let me, go to the summary. So I'll get back to that. Direct transfer has the slowest adaptation rate, and it was slower by as much of an order of magnitude. And free virus allows for faster adaptation, and artificial lysis has the fastest adaptation rates of all. And we only have investigated this kind of numerically and through simulation, but the ordering basically holds for everything that we've looked at, but we don't have any kind of proof, and we also have very little intuition.
Isn't that the reason here is that, you know, the greater, so the even more evenly distributed the chances are that you make it into the next fish, the higher the fixation probability. Whereas if you do the artificial lysis, you basically mix up everything that's there, that there is. So you destroy any kind of compartmentalization. Whereas if you take free like individual cells, which are supernated, that's something that's really specific to these cells. If you take free virus, you're somewhere in between.
So if you take individual cells, what was the?
Well, you direct transfer.
Yeah.
But direct transfer, you take free virus also, free virus and cells?
Yeah, you take free virus and cells.
It's surprising.
Yeah, it's surprising to me. So somehow, I think it has to do with getting out there. That's very hand wavy.
So you said you simulate this, so you must make some modeling assumptions, right? What happens when you lyse the cells? Like, how do you determine how much virus you get out of?
Well, the big thing is that you have to decide on a waiting time before the virus starts to build inside the cell. This is why there are a couple different parameter sets up there. So here's the total lysis time. And we have to distribute that between getting the genetic material going, building the proteins that I need, and then I start to build mature phage. And I get up to, this is the burst size. I get up to be this way. But if lysis, artificial lysis happens here, then I have this many mature phage. But for the same burst size and lysis time, another parameter set we could take would be this, right? Still consistent with what we can measure. But then if artificial lysis happens at this time, it's much smaller, right? So we just did a couple, we took some values from Jim Bull's work basically to find some realistic numbers here and just tried a couple.
The difference between direct transfer and lytic transfer, everything's the same except that in lytic transfer, you burst open the cells first instead of transferring mm-hmm. both cells, and only the variants that are already mature make it.
Whereas if you take whole cells, you're going to have time for that late rise to actually be realized.
Yeah.
That's got to be where the difference enters.
Yeah. So,
it seems intuitively to me, if you're blowing open cells and you're sort of reducing the effect of a virus gaining an advantage based on one of these fitness components, and you're sort of just,
it seems like it's weakening selection, but look, it has faster adaptation rates when you do lytic transfer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's very surprising.
Yeah, if you have, my thinking about it, if you have your advantage, if you have some advantage, it's realized here. So if you have...
Yeah, does it create an opportunity for a variety of advantages to contribute to adaptation?
Yeah, you don't, you lose some of them here, right? And you lose... Well, you definitely lose some of them here if they happen to just, they're going to build a huge burst size, but they don't get to actually burst.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So is it broadening your investment portfolio? You,
yeah, just, maybe.
You know, blow everything open.
I'd love to talk about it.
When you do direct transfer, how do you determine how many cells and how many viruses to transfer?
Yeah.
How does that compare when you're just doing free viral transfer?
Paul, I think you do, you get things going for a long time and then figure out what the dilution ratio is going to be, but as it adapts, you're still stuck with that dilution ratio, I think. So they do sort of pre-experiments to figure out what the right dilution ratio is to knock N final down to N initial at the end of the day. And then you let things evolve and you just keep that same dilution okay. ratio, even though you're
So say you're losing tenfold. Then if you do only have virus, you're taking 10% of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
If I have virus plus cells, I'm still taking 10% of the virus
yeah.
plus 10% of the cells.
Yeah.
So you're actually transferring more genetic material when you're doing the direct transfer.
But you would have to.
Or do you correct somehow?
You have to correct because you have to get back down to the same initial population size.
In terms of both numbers of infected cells and virus?
Yeah, that's a really good question. What do you do with the infected cells? I don't know, actually.
You did something.
Yeah. What did I do in my simulations? I know we had a lot of issues about, for the direct transfer, getting the dilution ratio right. We ignored the N naught cells. So if you have 10, so you've got 10% because they're about to lyse.
That's right.
So you have your cell population, which in this paper we assume is just constant, and you actually add 10% of it, but those guys are all infected. And they lyse right away, and then you're still essentially left with the same cell population.
I think you're asking, like, how do you balance the inoculant size?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think, are you transferring sort of the same number of genomes or not?
But yeah, if you transfer the same number of genomes so that you always end up at N final at the final time. There we are. So these are the people in my group, people in their own groups, some funding, and wow. You really wanted to hear about fungus. I don't know, do you want a break?
Yeah.
Do you want to hear about fungus? You want a break?
Yeah.